Now, the parents who have sent their children, let's say, to Hillel, non-observant parents, wasn't because of a better Jewish education. First of all, they were afraid of integration. They did not want their children, we might as well admit to that, that's mm-hmm. the truth, you know. They did not want their children to go with black children for different reasons. They also, the more and more, the mothers began to become working mothers. Mm-hmm. It was very convenient since a child got lunch there. They did not have to worry about lunch. During the teacher strike several years mm-hmm. ago, it must be 7, 8 years, or maybe longer, I don't remember the year exactly, even the yeshiva got about 50 students from non-observant parents at all, you know, Hillel couldn't accommodate them, because also they were bitter against sending their children, you know, to get mixed with the other children. So temporarily they send them there. Mm-hmm. But they also had the advantage that they eat lunch down there, the lunch is provided. Mm-hmm. So the mothers were free up till 4 o'clock, whatever, when they bring them back home and so on. So the students who augmented the student population at Hillel or in the yeshiva was not, I would say, l'shem shamayim. It wasn't for sake of heaven. It was for sake of convenience. And they thought, you know, well, all that frumkeit is not going to rub off on their children because they really don't want them to be frum. The parents who are non-observant would rather not have their children come home and bother them with a lot of things. Now, I'll give you an instance of what happened one time to me. I tried to teach one time a boy a little bit above what he needed. And I had a call from the father, and he went home and told the father. He had the ability, he was a smart boy, and he knew Hebrew fairly well, he was a good student. And I had a call from the father, and he says to me, "Mr. Kass, what are you trying to do?" He says, "Making a rabbi out of my boy." He said, "I don't want him to be a rabbi."
Yeah.
Because the father figured that's too much, he shouldn't even know it. And I told him, I said, "I don't know what your son will be." I said, "I don't want to be disrespectful, but your son is not going to be a rabbi." I say, you know, it takes a lot more than what I was wanted to do with him to be a rabbi. But anyway, he says, leave it alone, you know. Don't. So none of them went there because they wanted a better Jewish education. And if it rubbed off on them, but they learned down there or not, that would be up to discussion. I would say some were influenced and began to change their parents, perhaps. But I know kids who went there, even to the yeshiva, who did not change. That the parents don't observe any holidays at all, not even Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. That they'll have non-kosher food at home, and they eat everything, and so does the boy who went there, you know. So being there did not make any changes on them, even if you spent 3-4 years there.
Yeah. You mentioned that there were a number of Jewish day schools now that did not exist.
So the Jewish day schools did take a part of the students that would have gone to the afternoon schools. Therefore, the student population went down in all afternoon, speaking of Pittsburgh. And I say that Pittsburgh is only an example of other communities. So what happened in Pittsburgh, in the community school, came in existence, well, it's about 10 years now, or 9 years, mm-hmm. something like it. Yeah. They started with a kindergarten and a first grade, and they had an eighth grade last year, so mm-hmm. it has to be about 9-10 years approximately. And they they started with a few kids, and at the height, I think, they had about 160 students.
Mm-hmm. What would account for the popularity of the Jewish day school?
The popularity of it is, most of it was integration. Mm-hmm. No mm-hmm. question about it.
As an alternative to the public schools, I think.
The public schools went down. Most Jewish parents want a better education for their children. And on one point, I'll agree with them. I'm not a racist, but I'll agree with that. A Jew cannot afford to be a racist, but I agree with that. When, and I only repeat what a black member of the school board said, if you take a bunch of dumb black kids, he says, and throw them together with a bunch of white kids who are also not too smart, he says, nothing comes out of it. He was not for busing.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Connolly. He's not on the board anymore. He said, let them stay where they are and try to improve the neighborhood schools. He was for neighborhood schools. He did not press integration. Jewish parents were afraid, and rightfully so, that when you mix up a class and you throw in a bunch of black kids with white kids, after all, it took the white people, look how many centuries to get to the point where they are. Education cannot be done overnight. It is a matter of evolution. So it did bring down classroom work. You know, a teacher has to teach the majority of the children, the majority. You have a few smart ones, and you have a few who are lagging behind. The smart one gets restless because he keeps on listening. The teacher has to repeat his same lesson 15 times. He becomes bored with it and becomes restless. For the middle body, so the teacher has to adjust himself that must, what is the use to go to a new lesson every day? If I realize that the majority of the students don't know anything about it. So it slowed down education and it brought down the quality of the public school. And once it became known, and most of the Jewish parents are intelligent parents. And if I would have children, I'd try to take him out to a private school. I'm not ashamed of saying that. Because I wouldn't want him to go down. I would want him to advance. So the biggest shot in the arm to Jewish day schools and private schools as a whole, and Lutheran schools and whatever you have now, came because of forced integration. And that is the whole story. It was not because parents wanted a better education for their children, just because, I mean, they wanted a better education and did not want to get them mixed up in classrooms where the process of integration will take many years before it will equalize itself. And there's no question about it that it will take several generations before there will be any. You speak with any public school teacher who teaches a mixed class and they'll tell you. What's going on right now? The language they are using in classroom, the disrespect they show for a teacher and for anyone else, and it is still a chaos in the classrooms.
Do you find any of this overlapping into the Hebrew school?
If it overlaps to the Hebrew school? No, I would say that what goes on in public school does not overlap into Hebrew school, but we have also our share of children who are very hard to be controlled, but in our case it's easier to understand. They have been in school already, some come from townships, and they've been around since 7 o'clock. By the time they come to us, it's a 3:15 and 3:30 and 4 o'clock. They had a day behind them, and sometimes they had bad experiences in school, and they're angry about something, and you can tell it at their faces. When I see a kid is a little bit tied up, you know, what happened? What's the matter? You know, and they'll tell me, you know, if something happened in school. And then I can tell, well, I'm really sleepy, you know. Didn't sleep good last night and all day in school. So we have that problem, but it is very minimal.
Mm-hmm.
It is minimal. It does not create a big problem. And in a case like this, we have remedial teacher. You know, if a kid is in bad shape like this, or his behavior is in that respect, he would take him out from class for a while and he would sit only with that one teacher, you know, or with our librarian, and she would teach him something, you know, on one basis. The same thing that goes on into the classroom. But that misbehavior from there does not spill over, because they themselves, when you talk to them, do not approve what a lot of other kids have done in school. And they'll tell me or any other teacher, you know, if you have time to, in classroom you can't talk with them much, but yes. When you see them privately in the hallway or on a break or so, before class, and they come in especially, they'll tell me a lot of stories, you know. They'll tell you, you know, about this one said and that one said, the trouble they have with black kids, sometimes they get hit by a black kid in the bathroom, and still, even in older days, all of a sudden, you know, a black kid comes in and gives him a smack and runs away, you know, you don't even know who it was. So they still have problems, and the problems help these private schools. So to sum it up, you know, that the Hebrew school, the supplementary school, can teach less and less from year to year. So I would say that the quality of the teacher has improved through the years. But the curriculum becomes poorer for the simple reason that there is less time to teach. If you only have the kid twice a week, there's definitely you can't do what you've done in 4 weeks.
Yes.
As far as the quality of the teachers themselves, from year to year, the teachers have improved.
I see.
The old type teacher, if you want to go like take 50 years in a supplementary Hebrew school or even in a yeshiva, you know, was only Jewishly educated. Jewishly, he had no secular education.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them were not actually geared to be teachers. They got into it because it was easier for them to do it. They knew a lot of things, and they had to use their own resources to be a teacher, with very little bit of training.
I see. They had no specific teacher training.
They did
training.
Not have specific teacher training. They had knowledge, which they had to manage themselves. Now, some of them, on the given a program, understood very well how to manage it. Not having a general secular education was a handicap.
Mm-hmm.
It was definitely a handicap, because especially to teach children nowadays, it takes an all-around person. Like, it's not enough to be a rabbi if you come from a yeshiva, let's say you don't have a college education.
Mm-hmm.
You really don't know what's going on in the world. You're so parochial, and you're
yes.
so one-sided. You know, you're a fanatic in one way, and you don't... In order to function better, you have to understand the world. So the teaching profession has improved. Little by little, if anyone wanted to be a teacher, had to have training. There was very little training in big cities. Even New York had training, but New York is not enough for the whole of America. So teachers' training colleges spring up in many communities. Now, years ago, the Hebrew Institute had good teacher training years back.
How long ago?
Oh, I would say that they still had teachers training about 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they turned out young men and women. Some of them are with us.
Who trained those teachers?
They had a step of... They used to have like the secondary education, but after the surges now. The Hebrew Institute had it. And from these older kids, the 18-year-old ones, would graduate high school, some of them were interested in Jewish education because they had them through the elementary and they had them after through the secondary education. When I come here, they still had it. And I used to teach the secondary kids. They were 17, 18, 16 years old. Some of them are doctors now and lawyers. I see them once in a while. And those who agreed wanted to get a job like in a Hebrew school. They figured when they'll go to college, it'll come handy. Took another year or so, whereby they taught the methodology, you know, to be able to handle yourself in a classroom. And they were capable, so there was a certain amount of training. Now, Leah Sklinsky, that we still have, she went through like this. She went through the elementary, she went through the secondary, and she went their teacher's training. And she was became a very good first grade teacher. She's a terrific teacher. And there's some others too that had theirs. But that sort of died off in time. So the quality of the teacher, then I would say in the last 15 years or so, more emphasis began to be placed on certified teachers. That having the teacher training alone was not enough. It was some schools insisted. Now the Hebrew Institute would want a teacher, you know, that had teacher training, you know. And I believe that through all their years they insisted on a better teacher than a shul would do. No question about that, you know. The synagogues took anybody who said he's a teacher and he could do it a little. And they did the best they could, because none of the other schools did compare to a curriculum like the Hebrew Institute has, or Detroit had a school like this, or Boston had a school like this. They were affiliated with the National Council on Jewish Education in New York.
Mm-hmm.
They were getting a lot of advice from there, you know, from real high-class educators, a lot of class. So little by little, they began to require a licensed teacher. They offered a license. It's very hard to get a license, you know, be a licensed teacher. So a licensed teacher was offered a higher pay.
Mm-hmm.
They started to differentiate a teacher without training, you know, maybe for beginners if could handle it. Then a teacher who has teacher training, certified as a teacher. Now most of the Israelis we have, they are teachers. But a lot of Israelis are teaching in schools where they are not teachers. Their only claim to fame is they speak Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
So if the husband is at CMU and they want to pick up a few dollars, they get a little job in Israel or here or there.
Mm-hmm.
The Hebrew Institute, we have Israeli teachers, but our teachers all graduated from teacher colleges in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And they're certified to teach in Israel. So some of our teachers have been certified here in the United States after having a teacher training. So the quality of the teachers are better, tremendously better. And I can show you what the license looks like if you want to see.
Oh, okay.
It.
Well, this is a, what is this? A license, a certification for...
A license certification.
For teachers, National Board
teachers
of License for Teachers and Supervisory Personnel in American Jewish Schools hereby confers this permanent license upon David Koss. December 29, 1972.
So when it became... When it became, it wasn't a necessity, actually. I mean,
Mr. Koss, what was your preparation to get this license? What did you have to do before?
To get this license is very hard. They require a college education. They require so many points. Now, I didn't have a big problem, you know, on the background of my education that I had, you know, that I spent. But I had to have various tests, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I could have gotten it. I told them that I am very proficient, like in Jewish history or the amount of... I saw their program, what they want, that I could easy, you know, do all that work which is required. When I did some of it for them, they didn't want any more. They told me just by talking to you.
I see. Yes. Maybe we can go on now to another subject, unless you have something more to add.
At that time, the Hebrew Institute also, in order to encourage our teachers to work for a license, some of our teachers had to go back to school for a while. Well, I went to Pitt myself. I didn't have to. I had a license, but about half a dozen of our teachers went to Pitt, and the Federation wanted us to go too. So
to
take up actually more classes.
The UJF is the Federation
the
you're talking about.
The Federation paid for that even.
Oh, I see.
They paid for that. And that was a number of years back. And maybe about half a dozen of us went. We went for about 3 months, twice a week in the morning.
I see.
There were classes for all public school teachers.
Mm-hmm. And you were enrolled in those classes.
And they included us in that.
I see.
And I'll tell you the truth, I liked it too, you know, because they all picked up pointers here and there, you know. We had a lot of discussions down there, and we were in classrooms. They took us to the Washington School many a time, you know. A public school teacher and one of us, you know, we used to break us up with them. Because we weren't too familiar, you know, to handle the class like they did, you know.
Uh-huh.
So they would pair us up and we'd go together, you know, and have a class. And at that time it was very popular, the open classroom, you know, that you teach them by their own speed, by their own abilities.
Yes. Do you want to say anything more about Jewish education in general or in Pittsburgh?
In general, I would say that from what I read from professional magazines, you know, we get the input and what from other places. Pittsburgh is a good example of what goes on in the United States. It's a big Jewish community here, and it's a good example. I would say that being watered down from year to year, that our children will know less and less if that trend continues. You say from 4 days, just because of the amount of time. With parents who are less interested, less committed, I would say, maybe than interested, less committed. And I see it every day. When we used to make a mock seder for several hundred kids, and each teacher was asked to contact one or two parents, ask them to come and help. Form a committee. They would form a committee. I'll tell you, Mrs. Wecht used to give us tremendous help. She would come there and cook chicken for 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And we would get a large committee of mothers. And they would go out. They would buy everything. The Hebrew Institute paid for that.
Mm-hmm.
They would buy everything they thought they would need for a Seder. And they figured everything out. And they would do and prepare it. All we had to do is bring in the classes. We used to make at one time a big Seder, then we tried to break it up, you know, it was very hard to control and, you know, too much noise. So the parents would do that. Now, you couldn't get a parent to do anything. Now, if you ask the only ones that can get parents to come and help are the preschoolers, the mothers of the little children, they are right there. If they want, like they're having a Hanukkah party, let's say this morning, at the Whiteman Center, there with the preschoolers. Any mother that those teachers asked said yes, there'll be most of the mothers and there will be grandparents there. Now, when we have, in the last few years, when we have open house, we invite the parents to come. We set up an evening, and even not too early, you know, we give them a chance to have dinner and so on. Very few parents come. The bigger children don't want even their parents to come. They tell you the truth. So since there is less commitment on the part of the parents, the results for the future cannot be too, I'm not a pessimist, you know, things change. But the way it looks right now, there's very little enthusiasm. Now, we can't get anybody to help for a Hanukkah party, let's say. We are going to have a Hanukkah party this afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
We had a candlelight ceremony, a little short assembly with prayer. I conducted that on Tuesday. But we had nothing for them, you know. But today we're going to have latkes.
I see. And who is doing that?
Indeed, our teachers will do that.
The teachers are doing
that. Teachers
are doing that. Do you think it's a result of parent disinterest or parent involvement in other things like work?
Two things. Disinterest, and they don't come in the evening neither. That's the best proof, it's disinterest. Parents' disinterest is number one, and secondly, working mothers. More mothers are working, they don't want to be bothered. They come home after, they don't bother me. So that actually changed that.
Okay. Can we go on to something else? And if more thoughts about education occur to you, just tell us. We want to know something about your home atmosphere. When you lived in Lithuania, I don't know if you remember
I don't remember that.
But in Germany, before you came to Connecticut, can you tell us something about the religious atmosphere and the cultural atmosphere, what you did together, your school, your social life?
Well, to tell you the truth, it wasn't that much difference as actually here.
Mm-hmm.
It was, as far as Jews are concerned, it was a free society in that respect. Jews mingled with Gentiles socially very freely during my years. And personally, I had in Germany a good life.
Mm-hmm.
Financially well situated, and I had a good home, and I had good clothes, and I actually did what I wanted to do, because I was pushed a little at the beginning into the direction of Jewish education, but being a rabbi in Germany was a very lucrative position. See, there's a big difference down there and in America. Congregations, in the first place, a rabbi is a very highly respected person in the community, very highly respected person, and he's a knowledgeable person. People look up to him. He was an all-around man. He was a man with a secular education, with a modern Jewish education, not a fanatic education, you know, not fanatic at all, a very modern person. And he didn't have the problems which a rabbi encounters here. I never wanted to take on a job as a rabbi, you know. I had offers for that. I didn't want it because I saw the problems they had. And I was, as a teacher, I didn't have the problems they had.
What kind of problems?
Well, you can't please everybody, and it don't take long, and somebody already don't like you. When a few Balabatim don't like you, they keep on to conspire against you.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be real tough-skinned in order to ignore them and keep on standing on. I'll give you an instance right here in Pittsburgh. And Dr. Stark made a revolution in Beit Sholem. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to rid himself of Rabbi Goldblum. They wanted a more modern rabbi, you know, he was too frum for them. Whatever the reasons, a younger man, another man, and so on. There was a big revolution, you know. 50 families left Beit Sholem at that particular time. In order to stay on, they decided that they would take a vote, a membership vote. He and his wife were sitting on the telephone and calling the members. Our neighbor is a member. She cried on the telephone, begging them to vote in favor of him. And they took a vote, and he had the majority. But 45% did not want him, and 55% elected him, so he stayed on.
Yes.
But if I would know that 45% of the people don't like me and don't want me here, I couldn't stay there. I couldn't stay there if 10% would vote against me.
Yes.
You have to be... So they have problems. A German rabbi did not have the problem. First of all, he wasn't hired by the congregation. They had a consistory system, almost a consistory system like they had in France until Napoleon days. Like in Berlin, they had like a Kehille, the Yiddish Gemeinde.
I don't know what that is.
Like a Jewish center.
Uh-huh. Jewish center.
Center. Yes. They took care of all the religious needs of the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
The Protestants had it, and the Catholics had it. When you pay taxes, you see, in order to run Jewish institutions, you did not depend on charity, nor did you depend on membership.
So when it was a central Jewish organization?
You pay taxes to the government.
Yes.
And on your tax return, you had to declare yourself. If you are Mosaic, if you are a Jew, a Protestant, if you're a Protestant, it was mostly a Lutheran, you know, and a Catholic. I don't know the exact percentage. If your income tax was $100, you were sent a bill from the government, from the national government, you were sent a bill for $110.